Well, we're in the book of Malachi. Just a second, I almost said Exodus. Book of Malachi. This will be our third week, I believe, to go through the book of Malachi. We'll read our text kind of as we come to it. But if you remember, the first week we kind of did a historical survey of the time that the book was written, even went back to, you know, a few hundred years and forward 300 or 400 years, see how it all kind of tied together and where it was at in God's timing. And I told you, I encourage you to read the book over and over and over, and I know some of you have been, at least you've told me that. And one thing that I mentioned, and you'll see this as you read it, the book over and over and over, is that God will make a statement, and the people will challenge his statement as if they don't believe it. And then God will explain his statement. There are five or six of those throughout the book of Malachi. And we're kind of breaking our sermons up around those statements. So the first week, the statement that God said was, "I have loved you." And the children of Israel said, "How have you loved us?" Question God's love. We found that in the first chapter, verses 2 to 5. Then last week, God was specifically, it seems, talking to the priest of Israel. And he tells the priest, "You've despised my name. You have corrupted my altars." And they respond with the question, "How did we despise your name? We haven't done that. When did we do that?" And we talked about that. We saw that in chapter 1, verse 6 through chapter 2, verse 9. And today we're taking the third one, and you'll see the name of the sermon is their question: what is wrong with our worship? Now we're going to be talking today about, as you'll see as we go through the text, the relationship between worship and a marriage covenant. Now you might think there's no connection between those two, but there is from God's perspective, and there is from ours as well if we are halfway thinking biblically. But we're going to be talking about that. And I want to make a few comments about the subject. If our church is statistically the norm of every other, if the people in the world, including churches, then of all the people who are here, and I guess I should say that are old enough to have been married, to have been married, then one out of two of you have experienced divorce. Now, I don't know if that's true in our church, and it really the statistic doesn't matter. But the point is that when we talk about divorce, we're talking about a subject that hits home. It's close to home. And if it's not you who have experienced divorce yourself, perhaps as a child you saw your parents go through a divorce. Or perhaps as an adult, you see your children go through divorce. And just those three scenarios, which probably would touch us the closest, I would almost say it would touch almost everybody in this room. Perhaps not, but it would be close. And just talking about that subject sometimes brings pain. Sometimes it opens up wounds that we thought were healed, and we discover that they're not. And I want to say this because when we talk about this subject, I'm certainly not singling out some particular person that I want to make a point to about divorce. That's not the case at all. We're going through the book of Malachi. The subject is there in front of us. This is the day that we cover it. That's why we're talking about it. All right? The text, our text today along that subject is perhaps the harshest statements that are made on the subject in the scriptures. The prophet Malachi makes some tough statements. We're not going to be going through the subject of divorce as far as making a list of things you can do and things you not can do and when you're justified to get divorced. We're not talking about that kind of stuff. We're talking about how your marriage or your divorce affects your worship and affects your relationship with God. So, with that in mind, let's begin with our text. The first point you see on the outline is this, that the root of the problem that God is bringing up, God through Malachi the prophet is bringing up another issue to the children of Israel. And the root of this problem is a broken covenant. Now let's look at verses, we find this just in verse 10. So let's look at verse 10. Begins with a question. Have we not all one father? This is Malachi talking to the children of Israel, to the nation of Israel. And he asks them a question. Have we not all one father? Can they answer that question easily? Yes, they can. It's a rhetorical question. It has an expected answer. And the answer is what?
Yes.
They don't have any trouble answering that question. Have we not all one father? Yes, we do. Then he asks a second question. Did not one God create us?
Yes.
There again, that one's pretty easy. Okay. Then we get to the third question. Why do we profane the covenant of our fathers by breaking faith with one another? Now, some of your verses may say by dealing treacherously with one another. Okay. The word there, the Hebrew word, means to cover something up, as with a garment. You cover your body with a garment. Okay? The idea is to cover something in deceit. Now, if your version translates it dealt treacherously, then you can see that. I'm using the NIV this morning, probably the first time I've ever used the NIV, because I want to show you some phrases. He uses the phrase broken faith. You've broken faith within the covenant. And that has the idea, but it's not a complete idea. All right, but that word, those two words will come back to us. But look at this third question. First question was easy to answer. Yes, we all have one Father. Yes, there's one God that created us. But this third question, why? Do you like why questions? I'm not really fond of why questions unless I'm on the asking end of them. Right? All right? They're harder to answer. And I can just see the children of Israel standing there listening to Malachi. And Malachi says, do we not all have one Father? Yes. Did not one God create us all? Yes. Then why do we profane the covenant? And I can look at them hoping their neighbor will answer and trying to not meet Malachi's eyes in case he wants to point them out. They don't want to be the one to have to explain this. As I thought of this, I thought of something I think I might have learned about child rearing by the time I had grandkids. You know how child rearing is, you learn on the go. When you're 18 or 20 years old, have your first child, you can't parent from experience. Okay, you've got to kind of figure it out as you go. That's the way God did it, you know, the way God made it. But when my kids were small, something would happen. You know, so I could be in one room and you know, I hear something get knocked off and broke in the living room. We're barking down, we're romping around playing. And I may know the answer to this question, but I would ask it. What did you do? Or no, let me say it this way. Did you break this? Okay? That's as easy a question to answer as these first two. Yes. They don't have to think about what the answer is. But when I ask the question, did you break this? They don't immediately answer. Why not? They're trying to figure out if the risk is worth lying about. Okay, it's not that they don't know the answer. Okay. Years later, after my kids got grown, I had this brilliant idea that is a bad question to ask. Because all I'm doing is, I know the answer, all I'm doing is tempting them to lie. Okay? So instead of asking, did you break this? Perhaps I should say, why did you break this? Now, this is a bad example. But instead of asking the simple question, sometimes we go to the why question to get to the root of the problem. And my example has shortcomings, I understand. But that's what we see right here. You go from simple questions to a question that requires us to think, or to a question that requires us to examine our motives. Why did you do this? And it gets to the very root of the problem that he's fixing to address. Why do we, and notice it puts the pronoun we in there. Why do we profane God by breaking the covenant? Now, second point is this. The specific problem involves breaking the marriage covenant. We see this in verses 11 to 13. Verse 11 says, Judah has broken faith. Notice who's broken faith? The nation of Judah, the Israelite nation. A detestable thing has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. Judah, there again, it's the group as a whole, has desecrated the sanctuary the Lord loves by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. Now let's stop right there just a little bit. See what he says. He talks about this as if it's a national offense. But marriage is not a national thing. Marriage is an individual thing. And though this was a common failure of the nation as a whole, it has to be looked at individually. Because I am responsible for the faithfulness in my own marriage. I can't worry about yours or worry about somebody's in Tennessee or wherever. It's not so much a national thing as it is me. Okay? Now he talks about, I told you the difference between the two words, broken faith and the dealt treacherously. And he says there in verse 11 that Judah has desecrated the sanctuary the Lord loves. Now the word sanctuary there is not referring to a place. It's referring to a holy thing, a sacred thing. And he tells us at the end of that verse what that sacred thing is. It's the institution of marriage. And he says, tells us how that took place. That they have married the daughters of a foreign god. So, at this point, the children of Israel start forming a question. So, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with marrying the daughter of a foreign god? Now, you're going to notice that he seems to be talking to men. He's always referring to the men who married the daughters of a foreign god the men who have been unfaithful to their wives, we'll see later on down in the text. It seems like he's honing in on the men. Now, in the context, that is I'm sure that is the case. But we know the application of that, it can be either way. It can be the man or the woman who is being called into question for their unfaithfulness. So, a foreign God, what is that? In our context, it would be marrying someone who is outside the Christian faith. The New Testament talks about that. It's taboo. Do not do that. Why? Because there is something about marriage that brings two people together in a sacred union. And the most powerful thing, the most sacred thing about that union is the sharing of your faith together. If you intend to have your life committed to Christ and you intend to live for Him, that is the focal point of your life. Everything that I do centers around the worldview that I have about God as my Lord and Savior. That doesn't mean that everything I do is righteous and holy. But it does mean that when I do things that are unrighteous and unholy, I do so knowing what I'm doing. And I know the failures of willfully sinning against God. And when a person, one spouse, and their marriage, you got two spouses, when a husband and wife cannot share that deepest, most sacred thing in their life, it is not good. And yet there are hundreds and millions of marriages. They're going to give it a shot anyway. They're going to try. And I have seen in the eyes of people that I know that I love a longing when you're talking about this subject, a longing that they wonder what exactly is it that I'm missing. How does it feel to be able to share your faith with your spouse? Because they don't know. It doesn't mean they're fighting. It doesn't mean that they can't get along. But there is something missing that is so important to marriage. God says, don't take the daughter of a foreign god as your spouse. Over and over again, you'll see this happen. A Christian man or a Christian woman will fall in love with an unbeliever. And they love them, they seem like they get along good. And it's like Robbie Zacharias said one time, you better enjoy it because this is as nice as it gets. Okay? When you get married, you begin to take each other for granted. This is kind of the way it is beforehand. But we tend to look at that unbelieving person that we have fallen in love with and we think, I'll change them. God will use me to bring them to Christ. And you may be right. That certainly has happened. But presuming upon God's grace is a dangerous road to walk down. To do something that you know is foolish, to do something you know is unwise, counting on God to bail you out is not the road to take. We see the first hint here in these verses, I think it'd be in verse 12, where Malachi speaks with harshness, it seems. Verse 12, he says, as for the man who does this, what is the man doing? Marrying the daughter of a foreign god. As for the man who does this, whoever he may be, may the Lord cut him off from the tents of Jacob. Desiring and praying that God would remove this man who breaks covenant with God in such a way that he would get him out of the way. That's pretty rough, isn't it? Then he gives a condition, or not really a condition, even, he says, even if he brings offerings to the Lord Almighty. So he's painting a portrait here of a man who puts away his wife, divorces his wife. We'll see that that's included in this here in a few more verses. And marries the daughter of a foreigner. And then he comes to God wanting forgiveness, perhaps, wanting to offer his worship to God in such a circumstance, a presumptuous circumstance. He goes on in verse 13. He says, another thing you do. You flood the Lord's altar with tears. You weep and wail because he no longer pays attention to your offerings or accepts them with pleasure from your hands. Now, why are they coming to the altar weeping and wailing? Why are they coming with tears to the Lord's altar? Hey, I'm not sure. You know, my first thought is that they are wanting forgiveness for their sin. They are in sorrow for their sin, and they come to God asking for forgiveness. Perhaps that's the case. Perhaps they feel guilty, and they want their guilt forgiven. They want their sins forgiven. Perhaps that's it. I don't know. I think probably the most likely answer is that they realize that they no longer have this interaction, this relationship with God that they had before. They realize that God is deaf to their worship. They realize something is amiss between me and God. It says God no longer has pleasure with your offering. God does not hear. God turns a deaf ear. And then we hear their question, their challenge to God. Why? What is wrong with our worship? Everyone sins, right? What's wrong with our worship? This gets us to the third point. The third point is this: the seriousness of the problem is greater than we think. So let's look at this. Verse 14, he asks why. Why does God not hear our worship? Here's his answer. It is because the Lord is acting as the witness between you and the wife of your youth. Because you have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. So what is God's answer? There's two or three parts to it. The first one is this: because God is a witness to what you have done. And God was a witness to the covenant. That is, in particular, what he is saying. God was a witness to your marriage. When you got married and you made your vows one to the other, God saw that. You ever think about that? When Susan and I got married, I don't believe that ever crossed my mind, that God saw what we were doing. I mean, I would have known that he did. I was worried about just making it through the thing, you know? But to realize that God Almighty is watching us. He is hearing what I am saying. He is a witness to my vows. Then when those vows are broken, God takes it, we might say, personally. Do you ever think of why there are witnesses to a marriage? We say there have to be witnesses. And I want to give you some thoughts I've been mulling over for 5 or 10 years. The thoughts surround the inclusion of the government in marriage. We act in our day, I think things kind of get lost. Why you do things that are done, why they are done. And things really get kind of lost. And I think for the most part, people look at marriage and the government's involvement in marriage, they look at that as if, to some extent and in some way, the government is giving us permission to be married. After all, you've got to go down to the courthouse, get a marriage license, right? It's got to be signed by the preacher or whoever married you. Only certain individuals will the government approve to sign that document, and et cetera. And we come to look at that as if somehow we got to meet their approval. Okay, I'm not, in fact, I am pretty sure that's not right. Okay, the government has a reason to be a witness to your marriage. And the reason they have to want to be a witness to your marriage is because when things go south and things fall apart, who's going to pick up the tab for straightening all that out? The government. The judge, the courts, all this stuff are going to have expense doing all this. So they've got a right to know some facts about your marriage. The witness that the government provides is usually the minister or the JP or whoever it is that marries you. He's their witness. But the point that I want to make is this, that just because you have a government and a marriage license, it does not make you necessarily more married. A marriage is a covenant between a man and a woman. It is a public covenant between a man and a woman, a public covenant that is witnessed by people so that they know what this is about. They know your commitment. They know your vows. They hear your vows swearing your faithfulness to this person. By following me? Okay. Now, God is a witness. Whether we want him to be a witness or not, God is a witness. And nowadays, marriage is taken so lightly that it's almost done on a trial basis. Okay? Matter of fact, marriage is taken so lightly that we'll try it out before we actually make a commitment to one another. Right? There are two ways you can break the marriage covenant. One is by being unfaithful to each other after you're married. The other one to break the covenant is to tear the covenant to shreds because you do not use the covenant And you live as if you're married when you're not. There's the presence of no covenant at all. That's just as harmful, just as wrong as getting married and breaking the covenant. God is a witness to both things. And God views this as a serious event, as a holy event. Marriage, what does he say here in verse 14? You say, why? Because the Lord is acting as a witness between the wife of your youth, because you have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. And notice verse 15. Has not the Lord made them one? The answer he's seeking is yes. The Lord has made them one. In flesh and spirit, they are his. And why one? Marriage, there is something sacred about being married. There is something sacred about being husband and wife. There is something sacred about the sexual act within marriage. That is a sacred thing. And yet it's just tossed aside as if it is nothing. Marriage involves risk. Someone, I heard, read this on that valuable source of wisdom, Facebook newsfeed. This state, which makes a good point. It said, grief is the price you pay for loving. Now that's an interesting statement. And to some extent, it's true. Because there is a sense in which you can reduce your grief by never loving. There's instances in my life and in my wife's life where you find yourself withholding an emotional attachment that you wish you could have, that you know you should have. Yet you withhold it because you have learned not to play with rattlesnakes. So you find yourself holding somewhat at arm's length, withholding, it seems, your love because it has been too much. It's not something you necessarily choose to do. You look around and find you have done it. There is risk involved in marriage. You make yourself vulnerable in a way that you have never experienced before. And if you think about it for very long, especially if you young people have never been married, sounds like I'm trying to talk you out of it. And I'm not, but I'm just wanting you to know the facts. There is risk involved. Mm-hmm. That is why it is important not to marry the daughter or the son of a strange God. Mm-hmm. The story is told of Mark Twain. Mark Twain, from what I understand, was not a Christian. In fact, he was, to some extent, fairly hostile to Christianity and perhaps religion as a whole. I'm not sure about that. But he married a woman who was a Christian. And she knew what she was getting into up front. But like I said before, she was determined that he would come to Christ through her witness and through her faithfulness to God. He would see the light and become a Christian. That is not what happened. At their first marriage, they would sit down and eat with their kids at the meal times, and Mark Twain would sit there, and I don't know if he participated in the prayer, but they had said the blessing and grace over their meal and thanked God, and he was there. The day came when Mark Twain told his wife, says, I'm a hypocrite. I'm not going to participate in this because I don't believe in it. I don't live that way. This is not me. So he backed out a little at a time, a little at a time. Left her, if the kids were going to have any kind of spiritual training and upbringing, it was on her shoulders. But over the course of years, here's what happened. She got worn down. Not because perhaps he was mean, but because she needed someone to walk with her as a Christian. And she, if you're married, you need it from your spouse. She was not getting that. And he was antagonistic toward Christianity. So she was fighting that battle. If nothing else, just the presence of that there. They might not have been debating it and fighting it, you know, verbally, but it was just there all of the time. And gradually she got worn down. And one day he asked her, he said, I don't care if you, after several years had went by, I don't care if you, practice your Christian faith at our home. She said, I have none. It was over. The risk that she took, making herself vulnerable in the presence and in a union with such a man, revealed something about her own faith. It is rare. It is rare that two people can share their lives in such a way and they end up coming to Christ. The second one coming to Christ to follow the first one. It happens. It happens. I know people that it has happened. But it's rare. But here's the deal. God has wired us to want to be married. God has wired us, for the most part, again, there are exceptions, I understand, but God has wired us to want to take that risk. And there is incredible amount of joy. There's an incredible amount of satisfaction in being married. There is. It can either be a wonderful undertaking, or it can be hell on earth. Okay? It can be one or the other. God always, if you see in verse 15, has not the Lord made them one in flesh and spirit? They are his. And why one? Now notice the next phrase. Because he was seeking godly offspring. Now where did that come from? Did God have marriage in mind just because a man and woman could repopulate the earth or populate the earth? No, but that's part of it. God plan and God's will and God's intent is that two Christians marry and reproduce. and have children and raise them to know the faith and to understand the faith. That is God's will for a marriage, for a home. There's another thing that he says here. God comes to the man, we see here, and is talking to the man. The man, the husband, is always primarily responsible for the spiritual development of his home. It is the man where the buck stops. When God comes calling at your house, if he did, to check on the spiritual development of your home, he's not coming to talk to your wife. He's coming to talk to you. You can see I'm talking to the men right now at the moment. He's coming and talking to talk to the husband. It is the husband's responsibility to see that his family is being nurtured spiritually. Now, that doesn't mean he's got to sit everybody down and read the Bible to them every night. There's a million ways that can be done. But everybody ought to know, Dad's taking care of this. When you think of a family and someone asks the question, who is the spiritual leader in that home? You ought to be able to identify the father as the spiritual leader in that home. Doesn't mean he can do things the best or all that kind of stuff, but it ought to be pretty open and pretty obvious to those that they are close to that this man is leading his family. Marriage, one of the greatest things you can ever be a part of. But you know, and I know, I have seen, you have seen, perhaps some of you have experienced the horrors that come from a bad marriage. And such horrors and such unfaithfulness bring ire and anger, righteous anger, from God who has witnessed that marriage. You see this in the last point there, verse number 4. The solution to the problem involves unrelenting diligence. The solution to the problem involves unrelenting diligence. You see, the last part of verse 15, he says this, so guard yourself in your spirit. Do not break faith with the wife of your youth. The instructions God gives, he's talking to the men here primarily in this text, in the context. Guard yourself, he says. Guard yourself in your spirit. Guarding yourself is an activity that every Christian, we don't just have to limit it to men, but for sure the men as well, guarding yourself in your spirit is an activity that you need to have at the front and forefront of your life every day for the rest of your life. You need to guard your heart. I think of the verses in Proverbs says, guard your heart with all diligence, because out of your heart flow the issues of life. Guard your heart. You let down your guard a little bit today, and you get accustomed to that little bit. It's not long before you've let your guard down a little bit more, and a little bit more, and you have a new normal that you are operating with. And before you know it, you're divorced. Before you know it, you're unfaithful to your spouse. guard your heart. Verse 16, God says this, I hate divorce, says the Lord God of Israel. I hate divorce. I can't think, perhaps there is some, but I can't think right now of any other particular sin in the scriptures that God singles out and he says, I hate this. Perhaps there is. But he does say it about this. I hate divorce. And then there's the word and. I hate divorce and. I hate a man's covering himself with violence as well as with his garment. Here is how God describes the effects of divorce. Covering yourself with violence. If you've been involved in a divorce, more than likely you can relate to what that looks like. I'm not talking necessarily about bruises and cuts and baseball bats and stuff like that, but maybe I am. But we're talking about anger. We're talking about strife. We're talking about children who are forced to choose between a mom and a dad. A choice a child should never have to make. And yet there are millions and millions of children who are living just that way. Every day. It's on their mind. Every day, someone is wondering, when I get home from school, is mom going to be there? Is dad going to be there? An 8-year-old child should never have to think about that. Two parents can't get along and they think that the best thing to do is to get a divorce and break this up. And I guarantee you, I can tell you situations where I would say, you need to leave. You need to get divorced. I mean, there are situations that can be so bad and so evil and so violent that I can understand. But I think so often the parent assumes the child will understand. They think that the child will not be so horribly affected. And that is wishful thinking. That is not the case. I have seen and I have wished that some young children could just forget about one of their parents, like I wanted to forget. And it took a while for me to realize that this child loves their parents. I told this, I think, last week or so. That is grace. It is grace from God that little kids will love their parents. I don't care how godly you are, you will not totally earn your children's love. God graces that in them from their birth. And you benefit from it. God hates it. But you know the harm that comes to a child, though it can be great, and it is great. The chaos and the violence that divorcing spouses cover themselves with is great, and it is horrible, and it is wrong, and it is bad. But it is not the worst thing about divorce. Worse than that, though that touches our lives, worse than that is the fact that you have broken your faith with God. You have made a covenant before God that now you have broken. You have torn it apart. And God hates it. God is a witness to what you have done. The end of verse 16, he repeats this. We've talked about what repetition means in the scriptures. It's there for emphasis. He says, so guard yourself. At the end of verse 16, in your spirit, and do not break faith. I want to encourage you with this thought, this admonition that he gives two times in this text. I don't know of anyone in our church specifically that's marriage is on the rocks. Maybe. But I want to admonish you. I want to admonish myself. Guard your heart. You men, guard your heart diligently. Day in and day out. Guard your heart. Don't fool yourself into thinking the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. It is not. So what if it is? The price to get there is too great. Marry someone if you're not married. Marry someone who can share your faith. And I know this is a... Sometimes I see, perhaps even talk to kids or teenagers, whatever. And it seems like they got their head on their shoulders good. They're wanting to live for God. Just seems like there's no options. Just seems like there's no one who shares their commitment to God. You can look around and see something wrong with everybody, seems like. It seems like the pool of available committed Christian young men and women is pretty small. Sometimes I think we're perhaps tempted just to take the best available option, to compromise a little bit here and a little bit there. And I don't know that that's, we make it harder than it is. You know, I don't know about all that. But I do know that your heart needs to be given primarily and first to God. I don't need to try to correct your marriage first. I need first to make sure that my focus and my love is first to God. My wife needs to make sure that first her love is first to God. If her commitment and her view of life is God-centered and her walk with God is the most important thing in her life, and it's the most important thing in my life, we'll make it. I told you this statistic. I've remembered this number for since 1976. I don't know why I remember it. I was a senior in high school or right out of high school, and right down the road here, there's a Baptist church. And I was in a class for people my age. We were going through a little book, and probably, it may have been on marriage, I don't know. But I do remember this, that the author made this comment. He said the statistics, the divorce rate in the United States in 1976 was almost 1 out of 2. Okay? And it's still that way. Perhaps a little bit more, perhaps. 1 out of 2. But they had done a poll, and the poll said numbers were this, that for a husband and wife who were both committed, their life was really committed to God and to following Jesus Christ, and they shared their faith together, the divorce rate was 1 out of 1,016. What's the difference? Okay? It's where your life is. It's where your life is. You cannot cut that corner. You can't do it. And those of us who are married, don't think you got it whipped. You let your guard down a little bit and you'll end up in a hole. There are too many things in the world that pull at us, that bombard us with things we don't need to know or to see. It is overwhelming, it seems like, at times. And our minds, our lives get so accustomed to evil that we are desensitized to evil. We are used to it. Let's pray.